Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Megu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hello. Today, I am joined by James Murphy, co-author with Graham Garrard of How to Think Politically, Sages, Scholars, and Statesmen Whose Ideas Have Shaped the World. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Your book, it's had a hearty endorsement from Steven Pinker. It's been out for a while, but for our listeners who aren't familiar with you, can you please give us a bit of your background and the background to your interest in the subject of political thought?
Sure. Well, I'm a professor of government at Dartmouth College in the United States. Ever since I was in high school, I've been fascinated by issues in political philosophy. So I studied both political science and philosophy, both as an undergraduate and in graduate school. And I've been teaching political philosophy at Dartmouth since 1990.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you have an interest in Aristotle. That's kind of one of your specialties, is it?
That's right. Yeah. I broadly specialize in ancient Greek political philosophy, so especially Aristotle.
Right. And then I see Graham Garrard. He has scholarship, let's say, a previous scholarship on the counter-enlightenment as well. So it's kind of like, I suppose, is it that he handles the modern period and you handle the ancients and medieval period? Is that right?
That's broadly right. That's how we sort of thought of dividing up the labor. But because the book has so many more modern and contemporary thinkers, I've had to come out of my comfort zone and write several chapters on modern and contemporary thinkers as well.
Okay. All right. Yeah. What's the reason you wrote the book, and who was your intended audience, and why did you write it in this way?
Well, it's a book that's meant to make accessible the greatest thoughts ever written about politics. And in the original texts, often these thinkers, that access to their thought is not easy. They come from many different countries, many different times and places. So understanding what they're trying to say can be a challenge and difficult because of the historical, cultural barriers. So we thought it'd be quite useful to make all this great treasury of wonderful insights more available in plain English to readers who are interested in politics.
Right, right. So is it more for like, you know, students entering into politics, general readership?
I'd say both. I use it in my classes in political mm-hmm. philosophy. So it's a good student introduction to political philosophy, but it's also quite enjoyable and readable for any curious adult who just wants to learn more about the theories behind politics.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how much you have read or are cognizant of the work of Camille Paglia, but I know in her in her encomiums or at least in her battles with the postmodernists of the 1990s in particular, she used to lament the passing of these kind of great books, which, you know, which was so important to her own education in the 50s and 60s, these books that covered the whole history of Western civilization that a general reader could read and gave you this amazing perspective that a lot of the specialization and jargon-filled scholarship was totally missing. And to me, it sounds, it, I mean, your book sort of fits into that, these kind of you know, broad sweeps that gives you this this wide perspective on knowledge in that way, instead of being so specialized. Was that a part of your thinking at all?
Oh, certainly, yeah. We want to rescue these major figures, not just out of historical curiosity, but because they were generally geniuses. And the questions that they addressed are of permanent importance. That is, these thinkers are addressing the same issues that bedevil and challenge our politics today. So we want to give readers a deeper and broader perspective on the politics of our own time.
I think that's a very important phrase you put there, permanent importance, because I don't see the book as being particularly ideological, but there certainly is, but certainly the idea that there exists a permanent importance, you know, is quite different from the prevailing postmodernism, where there's no truth and everything is contextualized and socially constructed and contingent. It really provides a different perspective from that. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yes, you put it very well. I mean, that's right. We think that human politics has had many common features, both over time and across different societies and nations, and that it's important to identify and address those common features, those permanent questions that face all political societies.
Yeah, and it's interesting the way you title the chapters. I mean, you have 30 chapters, and it's Confucius, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Al-Farabi, Maimonides, Aquinas, etc., Machiavelli, and up to the present day. But with each of them, you give them a sort of archetypical feature. Confucius the sage, Plato the dramatist, Aristotle the biologist, Augustine the realist, Nietzsche this psychologist, Gandhi the warrior, etc. Was any of a Jungian sort of framework a part of your thinking?
Yeah, in a way, I hadn't thought of it in terms of Carl Jung and his notion of archetypes, but yeah, in a way, that's right. We thought of these titles, these epithets, as a way to capture in one word sort of the basic stance of these various thinkers. I wanted to clarify one thing you said that I need to clarify a little, as you talked about a Western civilization. But our book, of course, extends beyond the West, right? We include Islamic thinkers, Chinese thinkers, Gandhi from India. So we include thinkers from around the globe, not merely Western thinkers.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to comment on that because it's very rare. And in fact, I can't think of a book like this that, you know, starts off with Confucius rather than Plato. Usually, you know, books on political philosophy and political thinking start with Plato, but you start with Confucius. And then I was very surprised to see Al-Farabi and Maimonides included. Those usually are, more specialist people looking at. I mean, Leo Strauss and those people looked at them quite a bit because of their interest in Plato. And then, then you have Aquinas and, so you've got you take seriously the medieval religious thought as part of political thinking. So it's as you said, Gandhi. But what very much surprised me was seeing Sayyid Qutb from the Muslim Brotherhood. I thought that was a very, very interesting, choice. You want to expand on that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I wrote the chapters on the Islamic thinkers, right, Al-Farabi and Qutb. And it's funny that, if this book had been written 100 years ago, people would think that Islamic thinkers like Al-Farabi were totally irrelevant to modern society, as we thought this was the age of progress and rationalism and the spread of Western democracy. But of course, now with the rise of militant Islam, we're aware that these questions of religion and politics and the challenge that Islam poses to modern politics is a pressing and urgent matter. So the Islamic thinkers like Al-Farabi and then the contemporary Qutb are of essential importance for understanding politics in the world today. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is the first political theory book I've seen that, general, that includes Sayyid Qutb in it. So that's, I think, definitely pioneering. I mean, you might find Gandhi here and there, so it's, you're breaking ground, I would say, from what I see. Now to condense the history of political thought to 30 thinkers, obviously, you have to cut out a lot of important people. Is there anybody on the cutting room floor that you wished you could have included?
That's a great question. Sure, we couldn't treat everyone. We didn't treat. Just going from the medieval period. I had drafted a chapter on Marsilius of Padua,
okay,
a medieval Aristotelian who's considered kind of a prophet of modern secular politics, a fascinating figure. But he didn't make the cut. Certainly there are many contemporary thinkers. We couldn't include everyone. For example, Isaiah Berlin, or
right,
Michael Oakeshott.
Mm-hmm.
There's some important contemporary political theorists that we just couldn't include everyone. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask about Berlin, because just as you talked about the Islamic world and Islamic thinking, certainly nationalism has come back with a vengeance, I think. It certainly seems so. Although, Isaiah Berlin's classic essay on it was in 72. So I'm. I see if I sort of challenge you a bit. I see Martha Nussbaum here, and Arne Naess. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his surname correctly.
That's right. Yeah, Naess. Yeah.
I'm very surprised I don't see Foucault. I mean, Saint Foucault. I mean, he is all. He. I mean, the university is basically an arm of Foucauldian thought these days. I mean,
there's a little bit of exaggeration, but he's very popular, very trendy these days.
Yeah, was that done on purpose or what?
We did talk about Foucault and many other thinkers as possibilities. Why he didn't make the cut, is a good question. I guess Graham and I think that his theory of power is more of a sociological, it's more of a sociological theory than a political theory per se. Mm-hmm. His notion is that power permeates all human relationships.
Yeah.
So it's a theory of human society much more broadly than human politics per se.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, because it is a question I was going to ask Foucault, it's, although he didn't create the phrase the personal is political, but it definitely gels with that idea of the 60s radicals and stuff. But you're right that his idea of power and relations goes well beyond, government and elections and state power and kings and all that stuff. And it gets into discourse. So that's interesting that you make that distinction. So that brings me to one of the fundamental questions I was going to ask is, what does thinking politically mean?
that's a great question. I was not that happy with the title. My preferred title was How to Think About Politics.
Right.
Because to my ear, the phrase thinking politically sounds too Machiavellian. That's right. Like thinking strategically, if you say mm-hmm. to someone, you should think politically, that means you should think in a way that you can manipulate other people to get your goals, right. To realize your aims, kind of a devious way. So I worry that thinking politically could have that kind of instrumental Machiavellian flavor, but,
Graham won that argument.
No, we authors, this is one of the secrets about publishing this. Authors don't have final say over titles.
Right, so there's a publisher.
That's right. The publisher gets inside the title. So,
Right. I'll tell you, when I saw it, though, it brought to mind Bernard Crick in Defense of Politics. And his view of politics is a very specific Aristotelian view of politics. And I thought that perhaps that's what you were alluding to, that when Aristotle talks about politics, he means a very, very definite way of, I suppose, organizing a community and discussion and debate and so forth.
Yeah, it's well said. Yeah, I like the Crick book very much, and so does Graham. And I think personally, we both are quite sympathetic to Crick's understanding of politics, which, as you say, is kind of Aristotelian. It's the view that politics is the activity of resolving disputes by means of arguments rather than by means of force or fraud. Mm-hmm. So if that's what Aristotle means by politics, and I think that's what Crick means, then, yeah, I think personally, Graham and I favor that conception of politics. But in our book, we, of course, are trying to cover a much wider range of views of politics than that Aristotelian, Crickian view. So we consider lots of other different kinds of understandings of politics. But I'm personally quite sympathetic to that view that you mentioned.
Yeah, I could see that. And so let me just get to this distinction, because the Foucauldian understanding is so pervasive and so many people talk about things like governmentality and stuff. So your preferred title was How to Think About Politics. So how does your definition or understanding of politics differ from this more discursive, power-based, sociological power-based understanding of politics?
Okay, well, big questions. I'm certainly, as a specialist in ancient Greek philosophy, I'm maybe not the best person to ask about Foucault, but yeah. I did study some of his books in grad school.
This is a bit of a sidetrack, but it's very interesting because Foucault very much in his History of Sexuality, he very much relied on using ancient Greece as his model to deconstruct modern political theory. And Camille Paglia had this very scathing critique of Foucault that he really had no real knowledge of ancient Greek political thought. But you're not qualified to jump in that debate there?
Yeah, I'll stay away from that particular debate because I haven't read his History of Sexuality, you know, his big book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't read that, so I won't comment. But I have read some others of his books, like The Archaeology of Knowledge and other things. And I guess what I would say is this. Foucault has a conception of power that's not related to intentionality.
Right.
In fact, what's distinctive about his view of power is that power is exercised, percolates through society, is diffused through all the, you might say, veins and arteries and corpuscles of society. Mm-hmm. But there's no intentionality guiding that power. Power is exercised not by particular agents for particular agendas, but there's just kind of a diffuse power, social power of some kind. And I find that very confusing because I think of power as always the exercise of the intentions of some agent. That
right.
Power is the ability of an agent to accomplish what you intend to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And so power is always connected to agents and intentionality. Foucault just denies that, right? He just has a completely different concept.
Yeah.
Of power unrelated to agency and intentionality. And to me, that just doesn't make sense.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. That comes from his sort of Althusserian structuralism and stuff in the background there. Yeah. Because actually in the introductory essay in your book, you talk about power and justice. And that to me is properly and meant in no way critically, you know, an Aristotelian view of politics, which I actually also share, you know. But politics for Aristotle, I mean, politics was the second part of ethics. It's connected, politics and ethics.
Yeah.
Would you like to expand on that for the listeners here about the importance of power and justice and their relationship
Sure. I'd be happy to. Yeah. I mean, often today when people talk about politics, they talk about it only in terms of power, right? We talk about power politics, and many political science textbooks will say, you know, politics is the study of power. Political science is the study of power, how it's used and how to gain power and who should have power and what the scope of power is and so on. So it's sort of become an almost mantra or consensus that political science is the study of power. So obviously power is related to politics. It's not that that's totally false. A lot of political struggle and conflict is over power, who gets to exercise it and for what reasons. But it seems to us that that's not an adequate understanding of politics. Politics isn't only power politics. Politics is also fundamentally about justice, about what's right and wrong, good and bad, and good and evil. So we're trying to develop a conception of politics as the intersection of the quest for justice and the exercise of power. So politics is power that attempts to be justified, and justice that's empowered, right?
Yeah.
Politics is the intersection of the quest for justice and the exercise of power. So it's not enough. It's not enough in politics just to have theories of justice. Politics is not merely a debating society, right? Decisions have to be made and coercion has to be enforced. Laws have to be enforced. So there is a power dimension to politics, but politics is not only about power. It's always about power used, power that's been justified, power that's used for ends that are regarded as just. So that's the conception of politics that we're trying to defend. And I think it's not exactly Aristotelian. Aristotle, as you say, I think rightly, does talk about politics largely in terms of justice. Right? He says we're the only truly political animal because we have language, and language enables us to argue about what's just and unjust, which animals don't. Aristotle doesn't really bring in power in his sort of formal conceptualization of politics. Yeah. Now, of course, Machiavelli is the theorist of power politics, right? Machiavelli
right,
is the theorist of power par excellence. He talks almost only about power. So our understanding of politics, you might say, is an attempt to blend Aristotle and Machiavelli to bring the dimension of justice into relationship to the dimension of power.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, definitely. You talk about the naive idealist and the naive cynic. In a sense, Aristotle could be the naive idealist and Machiavelli could be the naive cynic.
You mentioned
that and it brings up, I'm not sure if you're aware of the work by Alasdair MacIntyre, After Virtue.
I love that book dearly.
And he similarly talks about, you know, it's the whole of philosophy could be condensed to Aristotle versus Nietzsche.
Right. That would have made our book much shorter.
Yeah. And this is a very important distinction you're making, like Aristotle and Machiavelli. And I believe Leo Strauss actually points to Machiavelli as being the beginning of modern politics, partly because he tears away the veil and the distinction between the esoteric and exoteric. But what's common to both Strauss and Alasdair MacIntyre, which I'd be interested how this fits into your work here, is that they see a definite divide between ancient thinkers and modern thinkers, right? And for MacIntyre, it's almost impossible to understand ancient thinkers because we've lost so much of their underlying framework. And something similar with Strauss exists as well. Do you see a sort of hard dividing line between the ancient and modern, or do you think that the ancient thought is, once you have a good guide, it's as easily accessible and understood by a modern mind, as a 19th century thinker or an early 20th century thinker?
Oh, definitely. I think our book stresses kind of the continuity of themes and questions across the whole history of political philosophy. Our book is not structured around any kind of fundamental divide in the history of political thought or contrast between ancients and moderns. Most of those kinds of blunt contrasts don't survive critical scrutiny. Some famous, the Carlyles and their famous History of Political Philosophy in the West, the six volumes, they claim that the fundamental divide is between Plato and Aristotle on the one hand, and then the Stoics, also ancient Greek philosophers, on the other.
Right.
Because Plato and Aristotle affirmed natural inequality of humans, whereas the Stoics already in 200 BC, right, a long time ago, the Stoics had affirmed universal human equality. Mm-hmm. They see that as the fundamental divide in the history of political thought, a divide that takes place at about 250 BC. So, in other words, any issue you pick, you can select your own fundamental divide anywhere along this whole long history. So I think it's kind of shallow to bluntly contrast ancients and moderns. I think there is something quite innovative in Machiavelli. Why a lot of people call him the first modern political philosopher. Strauss, according to Leo Strauss, you know, the 20th century German-American political philosopher, according to Leo Strauss, what's most innovative about Machiavelli is that he was the first explicit teacher of evil.
Yeah.
Right? That all political philosophers knew that politics in practice was full of moral vice and crime and force and fraud and assassination and all sorts of wicked activity. Everyone's been aware that that's been the reality of political life. What's new in Machiavelli is he seems to endorse or recommend those tactics.
Yeah.
The ancients and medievals saw the same, right, wicked behavior, and they denounced it. Machiavelli looks at that wicked behavior and seems to endorse it if it's done right, right? If violence and coercion are used economically, are used efficiently, Machiavelli seems to endorse it. So according to Strauss, that's what makes Machiavelli the first modern, is that he's explicitly endorsing wicked evil means in politics. Now, Quentin Skinner, another famous political historian of political thought, Skinner sees Machiavelli as innovator in quite a different way, but equally insightful. Skinner thinks that Machiavelli's key innovation is that he thinks that political conflict is actually a good thing, right? The ancient and medieval thinkers operated on a premise of harmony was the ideal of political life. We want concord and harmony. We want to all work together for the common good. Machiavelli actually seems to have innovated in seeing conflict, especially class conflict, as good for a polity. Conflict actually, certain kinds of conflict anyway, can bring us closer together, can give us things in common, and can create a kind of dynamism in political life that's better than a sort of stale harmony. So Machiavelli sees value in political conflict itself, and that may have been an innovation.
Yeah, that's a good and interesting observation. And not only have you have this divide between ancients and moderns, you also don't have the traditional divides, as you mentioned earlier, about the West and the rest. You have Confucius and I suppose even religious and secular thinking, because you have, you know, Aquinas and Maimonides and Al-Farabi. So that's very interesting and important, I think. I suppose there's a kind of enlightenment bias, if you want to put it that way, in a lot of the theories of political thought. And I don't know if that comes from Graham's counter-enlightenment interests or from your own ancient your ancient scholarship specialty, I would think that would have been a very conscious choice.
You're absolutely right.
Can you expand on that?
What could be an issue of more permanent importance than the conflicts between religion and politics?
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. There is a kind of complacent Enlightenment assumption that with the progress of science and reason, religion will just disappear and go away, so it's not a permanent problem. Mm-hmm. But we haven't seen that happening. religion keeps coming back, sometimes in very disturbing and frightening ways. So the challenge that that religion poses to a civil or secular politics is profound and permanent. And that's why we thought we would provide the background for these contemporary conflicts in some of the great thinkers of religion and politics, such as Al-Farabi and Maimonides and Aquinas.
Right, right. Now, of your 30 thinkers, which, you know, are very wide ranging here, some are standard people, Plato, Aristotle. I mean, you can't leave them out, Rousseau, Burke, but you have others like Mary Wollstonecraft. Who else? Well, Hannah Arendt, I suppose, Said Qutb. So let's say of the standard people that, you know, are kind of expected in an anthology like this, not an anthology, in an overview like this, would you say there were any new or surprising angles that that you provided either through your analysis of the work or by juxtaposing them with different people than normally they are juxtaposed with?
Yeah, good questions. There's some sort of, you might say, strange bedfellows in the book, pairs of thinkers. One could pair, for instance, in terms of Chinese thought, Confucius and Mao. We have a chapter on Mao as well as Confucius.
Yeah.
And those represent, radically different conceptions of politics, obviously, yet they're both Chinese. So that shows, again, the complexity of national cultures, of other national cultures. And on the Islamic side, we have both Al-Farabi, who was an optimist, you might say, someone who was confident that Islam could absorb the best of Western philosophy and make it only stronger, make Islam only stronger. Whereas in Qutb, you see this sort of fear, insecurity, kind of fear of Western philosophy and science, and an attempt to protect Islam from a dangerous contamination by Western philosophy and science. So here again, within Islam, we see two radically different stances towards science and philosophy. So
that's a very interesting point, and it shows the tensions within traditions everywhere, not only the West. Many naive Western thinkers, have monolithic views of other cultures. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Mao was a critic of Confucius,
absolutely right.
Specifically, Qutb. I'm not very very familiar with his work, but would he have specifically attacked Al-Farabi?
Well, I don't know if he would by name, because Al-Farabi has, a lot of stature in
exactly
Islam.
That's what I'd be very interested in. Yeah.
But certainly it attacks Al-Farabi's legacy, that is the attempt to build a bridge to Western philosophy is something he rejects totally and wants to build an Islamic civilization based wholly on the Quran, in particular his commentary on the Quran. Whereas Al-Farabi was a student not only of the Quran, but also of Plato and Aristotle, and sought to reconcile them. So, yeah, totally different. So I think one strength of our books is, as you say, it shows that there's no sort of simple-minded Islamic point of view or Chinese point of view or Western point of view or even modern point of view, right? That these categories are always full of tension and conflicts. We attempt to both show that complexity, but also guide the reader to understand it in clear and accessible ways.
Now, I know Graham had told me that you wrote 15 and he wrote 15 chapters, basically. Which philosophers do you enjoy the most? Which one? Yeah, you must have some favorites.
Well, I'm a sort of scholar, especially of Plato and Aristotle. So those are certainly giants for me. But I also have co-taught a course with Dennis Washburn, who's a scholar here in our Asian Studies department. And we've taught a course here comparing Aristotle and Confucius.
Right.
So I'm quite fond of Confucius as a thinker and interested in parallels between his thought and that of Aristotle. Mm-hmm. So those are key thinkers. I also teach Augustine and Aquinas. So in my teaching, I'm frequently teaching these great Christian theologians, Augustine and Aquinas. So those are certainly close to my heart. But in writing the book, it was real joy to rediscover some thinkers, especially Alex de Tocqueville, the French aristocrat who visited America in 1830 and just made splendid, brilliant observations and insights about American politics. And then I got to write about Gandhi, who has a long time been a hero of mine, but I hadn't really explored his writings in depth. So writing about him was a very satisfying delight. What a magnificent person and thinker he was. And then it sort of surprised, we were trying to figure out how to end the book. I made the case to end with an ecological thinker, because it seems to me that politics moving forward, both now and in the immediate future, is going to be centrally concerned with the ecological crisis. Not only global warming, but even you could say this COVID pandemic is kind of an aspect of the ecological challenge that the modern world faces. So our relationship to nature is going to loom large in the agenda of all political societies. So we thought it'd be good to end with a major thinker about ecology. And so it's Arne Næss, this Norwegian mountaineer, we end the book with, because he coined the expression of deep ecology. Mm-hmm. He was frustrated with what he thought was shallow ecology. Shallow ecology is a concern for nature only insofar as, we need to not poison ourselves to death with pollution. We need to conserve enough resources that we can survive in the future. And we obviously need to preserve enough habitats so that the global ecosystem doesn't completely collapse. I mean, he considered those issues sort of obvious and shallow. He wanted to push us toward a deep ecology, which is not just respecting nature insofar as it's convenient for us, but actually thinking of nature as intrinsically valuable, has an end in itself, so that we don't just control or make use of nature, but we actually acknowledge our dependence on nature and try to be good citizens of the global ecological system rather than attempt to be its masters. So he poses a very radical challenge to our conventional understandings of our relationship to nature.
Thinking of it that way too, certainly we can go through much religious thought and early political thought and find these deep questions about nature that now, I suppose, in the deep ecology, it gets put to the forefront after, I guess, being relegated to the back burner for centuries. That's a good observation and way to conclude your survey of thinkers there. Let me ask you something as well. It'd be interesting to know. Who do you think are the most misunderstood philosophers that you've covered here?
that's a great question.
Have Hayek, you have Nietzsche, so you have some. You have Marx, a lot of contenders, Machiavelli.
I think typically the most misunderstood thinkers are the thinkers who already have a kind of legendary status, so that myths sort of develop around them.
Yeah.
So it's typically, of course, often the most famous thinkers are the most misunderstood because they're so wrapped in their legends and myths that it's hard to actually penetrate to the true person behind the myth. So in that case, I guess, someone like Machiavelli is a good example.
Because, right.
To be, the Machiavellian is a word in the English language. I mean, he's so infamous that we've even developed an adjective based on his name. Machiavelli comes with this black legend attached that he's just this manipulative, devious, unscrupulous, immoral, right, operator. And our chapter on Machiavelli really tries to puncture that black legend and get to the important ideas of the man and not just reduce him to this caricature. So he's, I think, a very misunderstood thinker. Of course, as you mentioned just now, Marx, another thinker with a huge legend and huge mythic proportions, Marx is also quite misunderstood. And speaking of Hannah Arendt, another thinker that we devote a chapter to, Hannah Arendt was a good reader of political philosophy, including Marx, and a reporter asked her in an interview whether she, Hannah Arendt, favored capitalism. And she said, well, I like it a lot less than Marx did. And that actually turns out to be a very insightful comment.
Yeah.
Because Marx was actually a great fan and proponent of capitalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't think capitalism was important because it was preparing the way for the next stage, which, right, he called either socialism or communism. But while we're in the historical phase of capitalism, we have to endorse, support, and affirm capitalism. It has to realize all of its potential before it will collapse and make way for the next economic system. So, so Marx was ironically, his Communist Manifesto is full of the most extravagant praise of the achievements of capitalism. It sounds like the Wall Street Journal editorial page.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
So anyway, so there's some irony. So yeah, thinkers that have a legend or a myth around them are typically quite misunderstood.
And would you say that I would guess from your own history of scholarship that you'd probably say Aristotle might still be considered the wisest of them all. Is there anyone you would crown that way?
I'm an Aristotelian, so of course I'm going to see Aristotle as the wisest of all political thinkers. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, very good, very good. Yeah, so have you worked with Graham Gard on anything else before, or was this your first collaborative project?
Oh, definitely our first and only collaborative project, and I'm happy to report that our friendship did survive the experience of co-authoring, because it can be tense at times, right?
I mean,
you both care a lot about a project, and you put a lot of effort into it, and so there were conflicts, but we survived. Our friendship stronger than ever.
Great.
Though we're not planning any future collaborations, but this was a fun. The idea of the book was Graham's. He deserves the credit. He thought of the idea for a book about the great political thinkers. And the kernel of his idea, which I think was quite appealing, was to blend. Each chapter blends both the life and the thought of the thinker. So it's not just a abstract or tedious recitation of, theories and ideas. Every chapter provides a kind of biography of the life and times of these thinkers, and their thought has it grew out of that life and times. So that combination of biography and philosophy, I think, is quite appealing. And In fact, it's not our invention. This Steve Smith, one of the blurbs in the back of the book, Steve Smith compares our book to Plutarch's Lives.
Right, yes.
Plutarch, the great ancient Greek philosopher and historian.
Very high praise indeed.
Yeah, his books also combine the life and thought of these figures. So we think that's a good recipe.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't he also sometimes compare two figures?
Definitely parallel lives. Plutarch has
That's right.
He does compare thinkers.
So that's very interesting.
So that's the goal, the unachievable ideal, is at Plutarch's Lives, but we think that the book is fun to read because of this unique blend of biography and philosophy.
Yeah, I think so. It kind of reminds me a little of, I don't know if you know Norman Cantor's book on antiquity.
He's a wonderful historian.
Oh, I love that book. That is, it's so well done. It gives you such in such a slim volume, an amazing overview of the ancient world.
Yeah.
And I get that same kind of feeling looking through your book, you know, the way you give this, you know, very, very approachable way of understanding these people contextually. And as you said at the beginning, you know, I mean, if you have to read the source material, it can be very difficult sometimes, you know. And it's a really good way to introduce people, and I think it's a great companion, especially if you're a student. But you know, but if you're just someone who's interested in so many of the ideas, because I mean, we're living in a time right now where so many ideas which were taken for granted are now being questioned, and I think something. A book like this is very, very useful in that context. Would you agree?
Well, thanks very much. And at the end of the book, we have a guide to further reading. So, you know, now that readers will be introduced to these major thinkers, we provide them with lists of their key works and works about them so that you can continue to explore the thinkers who most interest you. And yeah, you know, one of our first chapters on Plato is all about the role of expertise in politics. Plato thought that experts ought to run the society. And we're seeing now, with the rise of populism, that idea of the crucial role of expertise come under direct challenge. So I think that's just an example of how permanent these issues are, that even thinkers 25 centuries ago are wrestling with the same questions of the role of expertise in politics that we're struggling with right now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And there's something you said at the beginning too. I mean, I pointed out that your idea of permanent, you know, questions of permanent importance, but there's another thing that really resonates with me when you say, you know, these are really geniuses. And sometimes when you're reading some of these, you know, writers, and you know, I just get struck by their genius, and it's amazing that they left the books behind so we can sort of commune across the centuries with these great minds, you know. And I think it's very important to introduce as many people as possible, because you know once you get into it at that level, there are going to be a couple of people who really resonate with you, and you've given such a broad range of thinkers and people that I'm sure people will find their own thinkers who will resonate strongly with them.
Yeah, I would hope so. This is it's a really astonishing menagerie in terms of the diversity of the kinds of thinkers we treat. So it's hard to imagine that anyone wouldn't find some thinkers that they greatly appeal to them out of this great variety.
Yeah. So are you working on anything right now? And I know this book was published like a year ago now. Is that right? Almost a year?
Yeah, that's right. It was published early in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working away. I've got a book that just came out. It's just coming out this month. I mean, I just got the copies sent a couple of days ago, and it's called Your Whole Life Beyond Childhood and Adulthood. So this is a defense of a holistic conception of human life. We often think of life as a sequence of stages from infancy, mm-hmm. adolescence, you know, youth, adulthood, and old age. I argue that conception of life as a sequence of stages really distorts our understanding of the unity of a human life, and that we always live, right, in every time of our life, we always live in relationship to the whole of our lives. So
right.
children are looking forward to adulthood. They're not just trapped in childhood. They're mm-hmm. already thinking about what it'd be like to be an adult. Adults are constantly looking back at their own youth or childhood, measuring the distance they've traveled. So it seems to me that the conception of stages is misleading, creates a lot of distortions in our thinking about human life. So I try to defend a holistic conception of human life in this book.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. Is that philosophy, politics, theology? Where does that?
Yeah, it's sort of a study in human development that has a biological, a psychological, and a narrative dimension. So our lives are unified both because we have a unified genome. Mm-hmm. Right, we have a biological unity. We have a psychological unity based on memory. Right, mm-hmm. the continuity of our memories gives us a psychological unity in our lives, and we have a narrative unity in our lives because we always tell stories about our lives. Our life is an ongoing narrative that we're constantly revising and updating as we experience new things. I argue in the book that we have these three kinds of unity in our lives: biological, psychological, and narrative.
That's really, really interesting. And again, I have to point out how oppositional that is to the prevailing postmodern, dominance in much of academia, where everything is supposed to be fragmented and fundamentally chaotic. Coherence.
That's right. Well said. And especially today, we celebrate, right, the diversity of human identities, mm-hmm. different racial, sexual, ethnic, religious identities. My book is about what it is to be human.
Yeah.
And that's not as often discussed these days. But
absolutely.
But I think it's important to be reminded of our commonalities as human beings.
That's right. And now this gets me into I wanted to close off, but this was a very interesting topic you brought up, and it ties it in. Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind, his book, which I think is a great book from the 80s. One of the things I think he takes Leo Strauss's division between the ancients and moderns seriously as well. And I think the thing that for him divides ancient thought and modern thought is the idea of the soul, whereas in modern thought you don't talk about it anymore, whereas in ancient political thought it was, you know, metaphysics and the soul was pervasive. Does your work touch on that?
Well, certainly in terms of this book about your whole life, because I'm so focused on the psychological unity of human life, that, of course, gets directly to the issues of the human soul. And I try to give, a kind of narrative account of how we develop selves by these ongoing stories we tell about our lives. So, yeah, I think that's a useful contrast. I think a lot of modern philosophers have thought that you can simply talk about human bodies rather than also about human souls. I think that's, of course, totally misleading because, as Aristotle would say, right, there is no body without a soul.
That's right.
We're, we're, we're in souled bodies or embodied souls.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It sounds very similar to a lot of the themes that Jordan Peterson touches on.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's very nice. I really appreciate your taking the interest, and I found all your questions to be very insightful and well-informed.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it. So good luck with this book too, and perhaps you can also have a discussion on that on the network as well. I would look forward to that.
Well, thank you very much.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.